Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and hopefully fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake, our first guest this morning, Menno Skilthausen, who has written Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Menno's part of a growing band of urban ecologists that have realized that natural selection is not so easily stopped. They are finding more and more plants and animals are adopting ways to live in the seemingly hostile environments of asphalt and steel that we humans have created in our cities. Carrion crows in the Japanese city of Sendai, for an example, have learned to use passing traffic to crack nuts for them. Lizards in Puerto Rico are evolving feet that better grip surfaces like concrete. Europe's urban blackbirds, well, they sing at a higher pitch than their rural cousins so that they can be heard over the din of traffic. We look forward to our conversation with Menno.
And good morning, John. Our second guest this morning is Park City resident Chris Fisher. Now, you probably remember Chris as the host of the four-time Emmy Award-winning Offshore Adventures, a television series chronicling a life at sea, fishing, free diving, and conservation. More recently, Chris founded and is chairman and expedition leader for OSearch. Fisher's company is a recognized world leader in generating critical scientific data related to tracking and studying keystone marine species such as great white and tiger sharks. We also look forward to this upcoming conversation with Chris.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts a variety of events throughout the winter season, including our new Seven Summits Challenge, weekly live music, Spring Groove, concerts, and more. More information about events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Menno Skilthausen. He has written Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Menno's a Dutch evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and permanent research scientist at the Naturalist Biodiversity Center in Leiden. And he's a professor in character evolution. I don't know what that is. We're going to find out. And biodiversity at Leiden University, the Netherlands. He's published numerous articles about evolution and ecology in three popular science books. He writes about plants and animals that are adopting in all these new ways as they live in this hostile environment of asphalt and steel of our cities. Menno, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Menno, tell us why you wrote this book.
I wrote it because we're discovering, we're discovering that as you say, that animals and plants in cities are evolving, they're changing, they're adapting in a Darwinian way, really a genetic way, to these new conditions that we humans are creating, and they're doing that extremely rapidly. And I wrote it because I think that makes this subject of what we call urban evolution a very good way to make people understand how ordinary a process evolution really is. You don't need to go to faraway places. You don't need to study fossils. You can watch it happening in your own backyard. And it really brings such a profound process really close to home. And I think that's what's great about urban evolution.
And your book has many, many examples of how this is taking place across different cities throughout the world. But before we start talking about that, and I found this fascinating because what I remember from reading about Charles Darwin is that evolution, it takes time. It takes a while to happen.
Yeah.
And you speak about a naturalist who lived in the mid-1800s, Albert Bridges Farm. He was sort of the who's who for butterflies and moth collections. And he made a fascinating discovery. He wrote an incredible letter to Charles Darwin. Can you tell us about Albert?
Yeah, Albert Farne was a butterfly and moth collector in England, And he was well known among insect collectors and many insect collectors in those days, especially in the 1870s, 1880s, when Darwin was already very famous. They often wrote to him with their observations. And Albert Farn did the same thing, and he wrote to him a letter that he had seen in a certain area in the south of England, that there was a limestone slope, and there were moths living on that limestone slope. And in an area where they had some kilns, some lime burning factories, which blackened the limestone and also the vegetation, those moths had turned dark themselves in what seemed to be a sort of a genetic way. Of course, they didn't know about genes at that time, but it was not that the wings were darkened by the soot. They were really the moths themselves were darker. And he said, maybe couldn't this be a case of natural selection, that these, because Darwin, of course, had published his book already a few decades before, so everybody knew about the process, but nobody had actually seen it happen. And Darwin himself also didn't believe it was something you could watch taking place. He thought it would take thousands or even millions of years. And Farn wrote to him, and he said, maybe actually here we're seeing natural selection in action, that the moths that are light-colored will be easily seen by birds on those blackened limestone rocks and will be picked off by the birds. And the ones that are dark, that have a mutation that makes them dark and lets them pass that on to the offspring, are surviving. So we're actually seeing the moth evolving. But Darwin never, it seems he never replied to it. He may not have had the time, or maybe he was working on another book. But it's also possible that he couldn't imagine that his own discovery of natural selection could be so powerful that you could see it happening in a human lifetime.
Well, and even Darwin said himself that, you know, we won't see these things happening, in a human lifetime, or we won't see them happening. And wouldn't he just roll over in his grave right now if he knew that in these urban jungles were where we are seeing some of the most rapid evolution of the species?
Yeah, maybe he would be rolling over in his grave, but if so, then probably for excitement, because I'm sure he would have been thrilled by the fact that we can actually, that evolution can be so fast that you can see it happening in a space of a few years, a few decades. Of course, we're not seeing new species evolving, but we are seeing species changing and adapting to the changed conditions that you find in cities.
That's right. Well, before we get into that, I'm always curious about, you know, what gets you into this role that you have and the work that you do. And you tell a great story in the beginning about some dunes outside of Rotterdam and your observation of ants. And I thought it was really interesting. Can you quickly share that with us?
Yeah, that was so. When I was a schoolboy, I was collecting insects. That was my hobby, and I never stopped doing that. And I was specifically interested in beetles. And it was in one area in the dunes near Rotterdam that I would always go to with my friends, and sometimes also with our biology teacher. And every weekend, we'd be collecting insects there. And at some point, I tried to expand my collection by finding some beetles that you normally don't see. Those are beetles that live inside ant nests. So to get them, you would have to dig up an ant nest in the winter when all the ants and everything that lives in those nests is deep underground. And I would find the ants, but also these very specific beetles which live inside ant nests. We call those myrmecophiles. Myrmica is the word for a scientific word for ant. And these are species that have evolved to find a niche inside this city that ants make. And I think it's a very good example of how ants are ecosystem engineers. That's a term that biologists use to indicate an animal or a plant species that modifies its own environment in such a way that other species can live there and can find a niche. And what humans are doing is basically the same what ants have been doing for millions of years. We build cities, we concentrate resources and food and all kinds of construction materials in those cities, and we provide opportunities, also challenges, but also opportunities for other wild animals and plants to find a niche in that new habitat that we've created for them, just like those ants did millions of years ago.
And Menno, back to Albert Farn and how all this happened. So as the chalk slopes became dark because of the soot, then some of the white moths are being picked off by birds. And there might be like a stray mutant, darker moth that now becomes more accepted because it's able to defend itself, or not defend itself, but it's not picked off as easily. And one of the keys, I think, here, because, you know, some people might be thinking, well, maybe humans are evolving just as quickly, is that their short lifespans allow them to have many, many generations in a very short period of time compared to humans.
Yes, that is one of the key factors when you're talking about rapid evolution. So many of these urban evolution cases that I discuss in my book, we call those, we use an acronym for it, that is HIREC, human-induced rapid evolutionary change. And when we're talking about really rapid evolution in the space of a few years or a few decades, it usually involves animals or plants that can have multiple generations per year. So insects can have several generations per year. So the larvae grow up in a few months and mature and already can have their own offspring. And for the evolutionary speed, that's an important factor because the generation time is like the evolutionary clock speed. Only in the next generation do you see the effect of the survival or not of the parents of that generation. So if the generation time is short, you can have quick evolution. And that's true for insects, for many plants, but not so much for larger mammals like humans, which take 20 years to have a new generation.
That's right. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Menno Skilthausen, who has written Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. And also, just to finally finish this line of questionings on the moths that turn black, they actually turn back to the lighter color when the lime kilns were closed and there were more efficient ways of being able to burn for energy that did not produce all this soot. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have a few examples where you see this rapid evolutionary change, and then when the conditions go back to normal or they change into a different direction, then this evolution is reverted. The famous textbook example of the peppered moths also in England, which is a different species of moth, and they also became dark, but because of the Industrial Revolution, which was turning trees black all over England and Europe. When the Clean Air Acts were introduced in the UK in the 1950s, which reduced the air pollution and brought back the light colored tree bark with lichens on them, and again, the advantage for the lighter colored moths, because they now were better camouflaged again, these dark moths disappeared again just as quickly as they had appeared. So in this case, you have probably just a single mutant gene which spread in this population very quickly and also disappeared again in this from the population. So that's a nice thing. And it also shows that even though it's just a single gene, it's real evolutionary change that you're talking about. But we're not talking about the evolution of an entirely new species, although we also see indications of that happening in cities.
John, I never knew you had such an affinity for moths, but now I know.
Well, it's a fun read. It's a book that you don't want to put down.
Yeah, and so let's make our way then into the urban concrete jungle. And let's talk, I mean, it's fascinating. I'm picturing the first person who figured out that carrion crows were placing nuts strategically so that cars would run them over and crack them. And then I can't picture the sort of the follow-up of the crows going to retrieve the cracked nut, but I'm hoping you'll tell us all about it.
Yeah, the carrion crows of the city of Sendai in Japan, those are famous among behavioral biologists because they, like you say, they've learned. We're not sure if this is evolution. It might be evolution of sort of a better way of problem solving. Of course, there's not evolution that for this particular behavior. But anyway, these carrion crows in Japan, they had been picking up walnuts from the Japanese walnut trees and dropping them from great heights on rocks to crack them and to get to the flesh inside. And at some point, some crow must have realized that you know, that's a lot of work, because sometimes you have to fly up multiple times before the nut cracks. And it's much easier to use traffic. So the first time this was observed was on a driving school, and I've actually been to that driving school in Japan. It's a large concrete flat area where the driving school students drive around very slowly, and there's a big colony of these crows around, nesting in the trees, and they pick up nuts and they place them in front of the wheels of the slowly moving cars, and the cars run over them and they crack the nuts very easily, and then they walk back, they stand back for a while until the cars pass, and then they move back into the street to pick up the flesh. And that behavior has spread in that city and also outside of the city, and they're now doing it in a large area of Japan, not only in driving schools but also on pedestrian crossings, where they actually seem to wait for the lights to change so that the cars stop, and they quickly jump in front of them, place some nuts, and then hop back onto the pavement and wait for the lights to go green, and then the cars pass over the nuts and they can retrieve the food. So it's delightful to watch, and it's the sort of thing we often see, especially in birds and mammals, that this ability to come up with new ideas, to solve problems, to not be scared of new things. That is, those seem to be personality changes that you see happening in birds and mammals in cities, which allows them to survive in this constantly changing environment.
Mm. Well, we do know that crows are very intelligent. They can recognize humans. They can distinguish one from another. And so I just have to ask the question, did those crows actually locate another driving school in another town in Japan? Or did it just sort of spread into areas where cars were moving slowly, which is equally amazing?
Yeah, I think they simply the behavior. I don't think the crows themselves spread. It's really that they imitated each other, and the behavior in that way spread through first throughout that city and then to other cities.
Yeah. Wow. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Menno, tell us a story. You can choose a story of your choice, of how this is happening in our cities.
Right. Well, my favorite example is actually the European blackbird, which is not related to the American blackbird. It's more closely related to the American robin, which behaves in North America very similarly to the European blackbird. And the European blackbird was actually one of the first birds to start colonizing cities. It happened very early on. Actually, a nephew of Napoleon, who was a bird enthusiast, made the first description of urban blackbirds in Rome. I think that was around 1810, and then around 1820, they were colonizing a few cities in Germany, and then it spread from there. And nowadays, you find them in cities all over Europe and parts of Asia. And because this has been going on so long, they really show, because just earlier in the program I mentioned that a lot of this urban evolution is not really the formation of new species. But in the case of the urban blackbird, that does seem to be the case. It does seem that the urban blackbird is really evolving into a new species, because it's changing in so many different ways compared to the forest blackbirds, which still exist. For example, they have shorter beaks. They don't migrate anymore. They have a completely different personality, which is genetically determined. They have different genes for hormones, stress hormones, etc. They sing at a higher pitch. They sing early in the morning, which the forest blackbirds don't do. And all these things are genetic. So some researchers have taken nestling birds from the forest and from the city and let them mature in the lab, so in completely the same surroundings. And still they show all these differences. And also because they breed in the city much earlier in the year, because they don't migrate and there's food in the winter also, there's no genetic exchange anymore with those forest blackbirds. So they're really evolving into a separate species, which you could call Turdus urbanicus if you wanted to. That would be my choice for the scientific name for this new urban species that we're seeing appearing in front of our eyes.
And our cities, in some respects, are crumbling, where they're rusting, or there's metal that's flaking off from the bridges and the buildings and the benches and everything else. So these birds invariably are going to ingest some of these heavy metals.
Yeah.
How are they able to evolve to be able to deal with some of the poisonous aspects of city living?
Yeah, well, many urban animals and plants are doing that, and one of the best examples is the city pigeon, which of course is, well, the ultimate city animal. They're really everywhere, and they can survive in places that have no vegetation, no natural conditions whatsoever. And they come into contact with a lot of zinc and lead and copper that is around in urban environments, a lot of heavy metal pollution. And it turns out from research in France that these city pigeons manage to cope with these heavy metals by putting them in their feathers. In cities, you often see that the city pigeons are darker, that they have darker feathers. And that's because they have more melanin, which is this black pigment, and more melanin in their feathers. And melanin binds, chemically binds these atoms, these heavy metal atoms, zinc and lead. So instead of keeping it in their body, they put it in their feathers where it's harmless, because the feathers are shed and then they get new feathers. And they can do that especially well if they are these dark morphs, which have a lot of melanin in their feathers. So those dark morphs, which are a genetic variant of the city pigeon, do particularly well in cities because they survive in the face of this pollution of zinc and lead.
Wow. It is amazing, this adaptation and the evolution. And I think when I picked up your book, I first thought, Menno, like, I first wondered, why is it that we have so much nature in cities? And then it dawned on me as I read about how a lot of these plant and animal species, well, mostly animal species, are imprisoned to a certain degree. The white-footed mouse that will not go somewhere where there's no vegetation. If there's not a green belt of sorts to connect the places, they'll just stay in the same park. Same with the parakeets in Paris. Talk about those parakeets and the two different types of parakeets that were found not far away, but they never mixed.
Yeah, that's, as you say, many of these city animals and plants, they need some vegetation, so they're marooned in little patches of vegetation, city parks or gardens or even smaller areas. And in the case of the parakeets in Paris, parakeets, this is a ringneck parakeet. It's an Indian species of a tropical bird, which was very popular in the caged bird trade in the 20th century, and many of them escaped in cities in Europe. So we now have huge populations of these beautiful green parakeets, which are living in Berlin and in Amsterdam and in Paris and all over Europe in large numbers. But they still need trees to nest in. They cannot really and to perch on. They cannot sit on rocks and make their nests on buildings like city pigeons do. So they need these parks, and they also don't like to fly over built-up areas. So they're quite isolated in different parks. And you see that when you measure the shape of the beaks and the shape of the wings and of the legs of these parakeets, that in every park they are different. In Paris, researchers at the Natural History Museum in Paris, they've done this kind of work in parakeet populations from different parks in Paris and found differences which are genetic, which probably evolved since they colonized the city and became isolated in these islands of vegetation. So in a way, you know, cities are our current Galapagos Islands that we can go on expedition in. We can do research on these islands of evolution in a city context, just like Darwin did in the Galapagos Islands, and found different finches with different beak shapes. And now we're finding introduced parrots in Paris with different beak shapes.
Yeah. I was thinking that an evolutionary biologist such as yourself, you know, might do their entire body of study right in Central Park or somewhere like that. Not even Central Park, just a small park. And you know, going back to that thing that you were saying about humans are the biggest ecosystem engineer. you know, maybe a final question is it usually by default, or is there ever anything that we're doing actually by design to enhance the evolution?
Well, I think most of it is accidental at the moment. Most of the adaptations that animals and plants are going through are completely unexpected and unplanned. But I think as you know, urban green design is becoming such a big thing in urban planning and in architecture. You see all these things like connecting parks with corridors and green building green walls and green roofs in cities.
Yeah.
I think we could use that trend to make the city greener, to actually stimulate the adaptation of and the animals and plants that live in those green places to the urban conditions.
Yeah.
And I think, for example, one of the things that people often do is connecting parks by corridors, because that means that a species cannot easily go extinct in. Well, if it goes extinct in one park, it can be recolonized from the other park. But those corridors might actually prevent the process that I mentioned earlier, where you have these local adaptations that those parakeets in Paris are adapting to the local conditions of each park. And if you connect the parks, then you might be swamping the genes in one park with the genes from another park, which may prevent this process of local adaptation. So that's one way in which we can think about urban design to help the process of urban evolution.
Yeah.
Menno Skildhausen, he has written Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. The book has just been released. There's a lot of buzz about it. If you've seen him in national news, he's on CBS on Monday. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, okay. Menno.
When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Park City resident Chris Fisher. He's the founder, chairman, expedition leader for OSearch. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Hi, this is Kevin Holliday, bike buyer for Jan, supporting KPCW. Jan's bike shop is open year-round for sales and service. We offer bikes from Trek, Scott, and Santa Cruz. Bike apparel from Gore, Bontrager, and Club Rod. Available at our flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, I'm Julie Hopkins at Keller Williams Real Estate. I share KPCW's pride in our community, and so I love supporting the Daily Lost and Found Report on KPCW and their coverage of Park City's fantastic nonprofits. For real estate, it's jhparkcity.com, and for Lost and Found, it's KPCW every day.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Menno Skildhausen, who has written Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. I thought that was fascinating. Our next guest is Chris Fisher. He's the founder, chairman, and expedition leader for OSearch. Now, OSearch has just completed their 31st expedition. OSearch tracks and studies the movement of tagged great white and tiger sharks. They share all of this data real-time with anybody with a smartphone that downloads the free Shark Tracker app. OSearch also provides K-8 courseware at no cost, and that enables students to learn STEM skills while following the movements of their very favorite sharks. Chris Fisher, it's great to have you back. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Great to be here.
Well, the 31st expedition, that is hard to believe. You guys are incredibly motivated, inspired, and aggressive with your expeditions. What were you hoping, you know, what was, if you were to say a mission of this particular expedition, what was it?
Of the past one?
Yes.
I think, well, when we started, you know, the real reason we're motivated to explore and pioneer and create data on the ocean space as fast as we can is our biggest challenge in managing toward abundance is a data deficit in time. So we have to learn what we've never learned before at a rate that's never been achieved. So if you want to do that, you can't go about it the same old way, and you can't go about it in a leisurely fashion, right? If we want to be proud of the ocean we leave our kids, and I think everybody agrees that they want to be proud of the ocean they leave their great-grandkids, we need the data to be able to manage it to do so. And so we conduct 325-day expeditions a year. When we started, the big goal was 22, because that was the bar that Cousteau set. And we never dreamed at that time we'd be, you know, continuing on beyond those numbers. The last expedition was a really tricky one. Actually was the first time it had occurred to us where we didn't even see a shark. We came into the southeastern United States right after the cyclone bomb storm that hit there in late December or early January, somewhere about that time. And the water temperature was 10 degrees colder than normal.
Wow.
And all of our animals, we could not find the right body of water between Cape Canaveral, Florida, or all the way north to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And so we continued to try to work and just grind out there to see what would happen. And it was a great learning for us. I think as an expedition leader, sometimes people ask me, what's your greatest learning? You know, my greatest learning there was I did not have the courage to tell everyone to go home at the very beginning. Because, you know, you have 20 or 30 people come and they've set aside a month of their time. And in hindsight, if I would have had the courage to send everyone home and reschedule things and wait for the water to warm back up, I think we probably would have seen what we've seen there in the past, and it would have been more predictable and we'd have been able to handle some sharks. But it's tough, you know, because you don't know if the ocean temperatures are going to warm up in a few days. Mm-hmm. You don't know if the sharks are going to be there anyway, even though you know you're slightly below their tolerance level of what they like to be in. There were some whales that had passed away offshore, and they were seeing some scavenging on those whales. So those little kind of hints were holding us there, and we kept hope and we kept moving. But in hindsight, I think it'd probably be one of the more significant learnings from trying to be efficient with every penny we spend to
right.
make sure we create data that I simply lack the courage to send everyone home.
Mm. Well, it's a very interesting, well, it's a revealing thing to ourselves when we're able to admit that sort of thing. So good for you.
Well, it's tough. A lot of people work hard to get everybody there. The
yeah.
people have given up their lives, and you want to try to still deliver. So it's, and you don't really know,
yeah.
right, if you're going to be fine a week later.
Did you have any sense before you went that the, of I'm sure you must
well,
watch
I knew the waters were cool, but I mean,
that
you know, the weather was returning to normal,
yeah.
and we all kind of figured the water would warm back up. When you're out there for 25 days, you see that sometimes. You think, oh, well, in 5 or 6 days, it'll be right, and we'll be set up, and everything will be flowing, and then it'll happen, and then it just never happened. It just never warmed up, and so it was a good learning. That's the first experience in 31 expeditions where that's occurred.
Yeah, I can imagine when the hurricane hit that it really disrupted the water and completely knocked the stream around. It would take a while to come around from the Gulf of Mexico and start moving up the eastern coast again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so when you look at the eastern seaboard and you look at the Gulf Stream, right, the Gulf Stream comes up the east coast of Florida. It hits Cape Canaveral, which is kind of like central eastern Florida, and it kind of bounces offshore, and then it comes back into the coast up around Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. And inside that Gulf Stream is a cool pocket of water. It's colder than the Gulf Stream, right? The Gulf Stream is more of a tropical body of water. In that body of water, you're going to find more things like tiger sharks and other species that like warmer waters. That cool pocket of water that's trapped inside the Gulf Stream is where the white sharks like to overwinter off the southeastern United States. It just so happened, because of all the northeasterly winds from these big nor'easters and storms, that the water temperature was in the mid to high 40s. Instead of in the high 50s, low 60s. And so we had some winds coming up that were coming up out of the southeast, and we thought, oh, those southeasterly winds will blow that warm Gulf Stream water in here, and it just never did.
Right. Now, we couldn't have you on without talking about our southern mothers, Mary Lee.
Yes.
Both named Mary Lee, and of course the shark named Mary Lee, who has beaten out the hussy, I believe, Large Marge. She was voted 224 to 74 as the most popular shark.
Yes, we did the shark madness during March Madness with the Cape Cod Times up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mary Lee has just been such an amazing, you know, the most famous real shark in history, named after my mother, Mary Lee Fisher. And she really ignited and shifted the tone of conversation away from that tone of fear from Jaws.
Right.
And really helped people get, without these big sharks, there's no fish sandwiches for our kids. And she spends a lot of time on the beaches, although it's amazing that she's 17 feet and 4,000 pounds. We tagged her almost 6 years ago, and no one has ever seen her. It shows you how nervous these East Coast white sharks are.
Right.
And so she's just been transformational for shifting the tone around sharks. You know, we knew we had the capacity to solve their life history puzzle. That's what we're trying to do, right? What most people don't understand at OSearch is they think it's a shark thing. It's not. It's an ocean abundance thing. What we're trying to do is make sure our great-grandkids can eat fish sandwiches. If we don't have a lot of big sharks, they won't be eating fish sandwiches.
That's right.
And so in order to help the sharks, we need to know where and when they mate, where and when they give birth, and how they move, the size of the nursery. So we cracked the code on capturing and handling these animals for scientists about 11 years ago. And for the first time ever, we're discovering those places so we can manage them toward abundance, move the system toward abundance. But at the same time, we knew we had to shift the conversation or the tone around sharks from one of fear to one of understanding and one of fascination. And I think Mary Lee has done more for that than any other shark in the world. She's the most famous real shark in history.
Mm. If you're just joining us, our guest is Chris Fisher. He's a Park City resident. That is when he's not out conducting expeditions. He's the founder and chairman and expedition leader for OSearch. And Chris, I'm wondering, well, first of all, I was going to ask, who names your sharks? I know it's not all about the sharks, but when you read down the list, I'm wondering if these school kids that you bring these STEM programs to have a hand in naming some of the sharks.
We do name the sharks after some school mascots that are participating in the program.
Great.
And particularly, the primary thing, Mary Lee is an anomaly and George is an anomaly. George is the first mature male white shark ever tagged in the Northwest Atlantic and named after my father, George. But and I do feel somewhat selfish about that, quite frankly. All of our other names, we try to give away to the communities.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to name the sharks about famous historic figures, after local schools, after local towns, because we want everyone to feel like those are their sharks. But my parents have done so much, and I wanted to honor them. It simply wouldn't occur without them providing a platform from which to leap from that made you feel like anything was possible.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. So for those of our listeners who haven't heard you on the program and are not familiar with OSearch, you just have to go through and explain the lift that you use, your boat. It's just fascinating, and I think John and I someday have to wind our way onto that boat so we can really get it in real time. But it is quite fascinating how you bring the sharks up long enough to tag them.
Yeah, so the lift has been transformational in creating the data we've never had before. When the scientist explained to us about 11 years ago that, you know, our game fish and our food fish were going to suffer if we lost our large sharks, we simply asked, well, how do we manage our large sharks? Where are they mating? What's their life history puzzle? Where's the nursery? Where's the baby? And they said, they're so big, we don't know. And I was shocked at the time because I was like, well, you just said no sharks, no fish sandwiches. And I like fish sandwiches and I want my kid to be able to eat them. And now I ask, how do we help the sharks? And you say, we don't know. So it was a cornerstone of data that we must have to be proud of the planet we leave our kids. And the challenge was the sharks were so big that you can understand why a scientist is an intern in a small boat are not going to catch a 4,000-pound white shark to leverage the latest technology to solve the puzzle of its life. And so what was shocking about that moment in time to me was the fact that we didn't have our best practical skill, our best watermen, coming together with our best academics to create the best data possible so we can manage the planet. And we couldn't figure it out. And we started to look at the structure of ocean research and why it happens the way it happens. And it's really siloed all these scientists into these individual approaches. Look, if we're going to be proud of the planet we leave our kids, it's going to take us all. So if it's going to take us all, there is no you and me. There's just us. There is no fishermen and scientists. There's just us. The question is could we get everyone, and this was the most difficult thing to achieve, on a common vision, great-grandchildren first, ocean first, with a selfless disposition. Everyone says they want to be proud of the planet they leave their kids. But does that mean only on their terms? Or does that mean they are truly selfless in the pursuit of that objective, if that is so important? And so we were able to create a vision and a selfless disposition that brought people together that didn't normally work together, which seems so obvious, right? And then suddenly things that were impossible became very easy, right? If you get the right group of watermen together, they can capture a 4,000-pound white shark. If you have the right asset or ship, and you have a lift that no one's ever used before that used to be used to pick up sharks, I mean, it used to be pick up boats and put it on a ship, you can swing those 4,000-pound animals into that lift and then look after them and take care of them, because people have caught and released thousands of fish over their lives, and they know how to capture things, keep them alive, and let them go. And so I believe in servant leadership. I love being a servant of the ocean, and my crew are true servants of the ocean. They have taken their lifelong learning of skills and now apply it to capturing things for scientists who can take their lifelong learning in the academic pursuit to publish papers to leverage for policy. And so these sharks are brought into the cradle by the fishing team. We've then built a big collaborative team of scientists, which in the past they work individually. But if we can get 15 scientists on one shark instead of one scientist on one shark, we not only learn 15 times faster, but we can solve the puzzle catching 1/15th of the fish and have a much less impact on the resource and the sharks. So now we have these, we have this lift. It picks up 75,000 pounds. The guys will capture the white sharks on a hand line. There's no rod and reel big enough for this type of work. Speed is the key, capturing them quick. And I would say we don't really catch sharks anymore. We quickly train them. They have a condition called learned helplessness, where if they know they can't get away, they give up. And so we put so much pressure on the sharks, they quickly give up. I mean, we'll catch a 4,000-pound white shark in 30 minutes, a 1,000-pound white shark in 6. These animals are choosing to give up. It's more like teaching a dog how to heel or breaking a horse than it is catching a fish. We'll then walk that animal from the little 30-foot contender the guys work in back to the ship, swing it over the lift, and then we pick the shark up. We put two hoses in its mouth and cover its eyes, and it quickly goes into its learned helplessness state. It knows it can't get away, so it just lays there. And that then allows these groups of scientists to come down and do 15 research projects on the animal in 15 minutes and let it go. And we'll leverage 3 different types of tags. We'll get the first ultrasounds, blood samples, semen from mature males, tissue samples for diet, parasite samples, bacteria science for drug discovery to help humans fight a lot of these. We're in our new drug discovery section of OSearch's work these days, which is very promising. And all this work gets done in 15 minutes. We lower the animal down, and then everyone can track it in real time on the global shark tracker, which allows everyone to be involved and open source the data, which is also something that was quite disruptive in the space. So it really, a lot of it seems like common sense. But if you think about it, we have this challenge with the ocean. We have a lack of data and no time to manage toward abundance. We can't keep doing things the same way, and we have to disrupt the systems that have got us in this spot, or we will fail. And failure is not an option in this particular arena.
So the rich and famous have enjoyed shark fin soup over many periods, many years. And when we first had you on the show, you were just starting to make some inroads in discouraging that type of eating behavior through a number of things that you were doing and other people were doing around the world. How's that going?
So we're going to win this one, right? Shark fin soup is the primary reason we were down to about 9% of our large sharks. And that's the practice of long lines and commercial ships, maybe miles and miles long, where they capture sharks, cut the fins off, dump the body, and keep the fin because they don't want to fill their ships up with shark bodies. They want just the fin, right? So it's terribly wasteful, and it allows them to kill a lot of sharks fast. That 95% of those fins travel through Hong Kong into China for shark fin soup. So we're losing about 250,000 sharks a day. And so as China, kind of the middle class, erupted with wealth in the 90s, so many people could buy the shark fin soup that their demand exceeded the ocean's capacity to create new sharks. And we started to see our shark populations plummet, which jeopardizes fish sandwich for our grandchildren. And so there's great groups like WildAid who operate out of San Francisco who focus on demand, right? We're focusing on data creation. And they have worked with famous pop stars and actors in China. They get a lot of public service announcements. And they have been so successful that demand is down over 40% in the last few years. The government's no longer serving it at state functions. The fancy hotels are no longer serving it. The kids no longer want it at their weddings, the younger generation. And so we're going to win this one. We're going to win this one. This is not a nonprofit, the sky is falling, you know, boo-hoo story. But we have to attack it with a sense of urgency and efficiency. We're driving down demand. We're exploding data. We now are starting to understand where and when they're mating, where and when they're giving birth, their nurseries in various areas of the world. And we're going to win, and our kids are going to eat fish.
Tell us about the relationship between the shark and the seals and the walruses, because you've through your data, you've been able to dispel some myths about how these different groups play together.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's most interesting about the relationship between white sharks and seals in particular, and also they scavenge on dead whales, is when we do our tissue work trying to understand their diet, even in the large ones, we see that they're vastly just eating fish,
right?
Primarily fish eaters. They eat some marine mammal. We know that. We see it. But as a percentage of their diet, it's quite low. We're not picking it up in our isotope studies and our tissue studies too much. But what the biggest thing that they do, and all apex predators do this, if you've seen the film on the reintroduction of the wolf into Yellowstone, the biggest thing they do is they modify the behavior of the second tier of the food chain. So yeah, they're trying to eat some seals when they're around them and off the beaches of Cape Cod and other areas of the world. But the biggest thing they do is if they're not there, the seals just frolic around in the ocean and wipe out all the bait, because they can eat at their leisure and they just gorge. If the white sharks are there, they wait on the beach until they're almost starving, and then they go out and eat just a little bit until they're satisfied, and then they get back out because they might die. So what they really do is they modify the behavior of the seal much more than they do by impacting the number of seals by consuming them. And that modification of their behavior allows then the bait to flourish. So the stripers in that region have food to eat, the fluke have food to eat, then the fish that we need to eat flourish, and our kids eat fish sandwiches.
Good. I was going to ask you for that same food chain explanation. It's very simple, maintaining the balance.
It's about it. But I think the biggest thing we've all learned really since that reintroduction of the wolf into Yellowstone, which was a fantastic, everybody should Google that and watch it. It's a little 4-minute film. It's fantastic. When you watch it, just know that the shark is the wolf of the ocean, right? Yeah. The biggest thing we're seeing is how the top of the food chain, yes, they keep things in balance, but the biggest thing they do is they modify the behavior of the animals underneath them, which allows every level to flourish, and then you have a system operating at maximum abundance.
Do you know of a school here in Park City that follows the sharks and uses, I've just been clicking through on some of your curriculum. I mean, it's everything from cartography to solving word problems in math. I'm looking in specifically at grades 3 through 5, and then you break it up for other grades. It's incredible. And what was the other one that, learning about graphs, how to graphic representation of data. This is just phenomenal.
But yeah, this STEM courseware is free.
Yeah,
it's all free and open source. Look, the idea behind the curriculum is a lot of times teachers have a hard time getting their kids excited about science, technology, engineering, and math, but they're all super thrilled to be following sharks. So they got their attention. So, you know, my parents always used to say, you got to live in the biggest room in the world, right? You guys know what the biggest room in the world is, by the way? Super important to know. It's the room for improvement, right?
It's the room for improvement.
No matter how good you get at anything, it never shrinks, right? So when we saw these teachers and the kids so focused on the sharks, we were trying to think, you know, how can we leverage that to do more? And they had this STEM problem, and we're like, well, let's integrate a STEM curriculum into the real-time tracking of the sharks. And it's been fantastic. I've gone and spoken to most of the schools here, particularly where my little girls go to school. It's been great. Our biggest users, though, I think, as you could imagine, are a lot of these coastal communities up and down the eastern seaboard in Canada, around the world. The curriculum's available in 256 languages in both the English and metric system.
Wow.
So it's used worldwide. And you can see the people who live in these very sharky communities really engaged. But that travels. It's really about the teachers. When you see the most creative, innovative teachers that also they need some wiggle room in the structure of their school, because oftentimes in the science and math, they don't have a lot of wiggle room to bring in, whatever they want. And then as well, we see a tremendous usage from homeschoolers, because they're allowed to create their curriculums, and this is a free, and this is the most modern next generation science standard curriculum.
Oh, absolutely. You must have a huge operating budget. How are you funded?
So we do a lot with very few people. I mean, the total operating budget of the ship and OSERTS, the nonprofit combined, is just under $2 million. And the vast majority of that is operating the ship and moving it around the world with, say, 600,000 of that going into the science and educational curriculums. But what we do in the modern era of total connectivity and open sourcing is that we've gotten a company, Landry's, who has an educational staff because they own a few aquariums, to actually make sure all of our curriculums abide by next generation science standards. And then many of the teachers around the world who use it write their own curriculums that they integrate for their children. They then give them to us. We have Landry's make sure it conforms, and then we open source it to the rest of the world. And so, you know, look, it's going to take us all if we're going to be proud of the planet we leave our kids. OSERTS believes in total inclusion, total open sourcing. And because of that, it allows you to do a lot more because people want to help.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have a massive staff and a massive budget because you can open source and include.
So you monetize the data?
We do not monetize the data. What we do is we open source the data. So when you look at our primary funding and how we do things just like Google. Right, Google created a product, gave it away, created massive scale, and they monetized their scale, not the search engine. So what we do is we open source all the content around our work, all the data, everything, so everyone can enjoy it. And because of that, we've built massive scale. We have about 1.6 billion impressions worldwide around our work each year. Well, brands that want to make business and do good want to be a part of that scale. So companies like Yeti Coolers, Costa Sunglasses, SeaWorld, Southern Tide, they give us the funds to operate, and we include them in our scale as we open source it. And then they can demonstrate to people that they're a brand that wants to make business and be proud of the planet they want to leave their kids. It's part of who they are.
And back to the earlier conversation about seals, if I have this right, for the person that is still watching Spielberg reruns of Jaws, that thinks that when the seals show up on the beaches, then the great whites are going to follow. That's not necessarily true.
We've got 1 minute left.
That's not necessarily true. I mean, you know, it depends on the temperature of the water. They are there some of the time. I think the biggest thing from Jaws that's wrong is, you know, you have the shark that comes into an area and has a territory and it stays there.
Right.
We're seeing our sharks move 150 miles a day, 17,000 miles a year. These animals don't move into an area, stay there, and have a territory.
Sure.
Chris Fisher, he is the founder, the chairman, and expedition leader for OSERTS. So great to have you back on the show. When's the next expedition?
The next expedition is the Gulf Stream Drift from Key West to Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, May 5th to June 10th.
All right.
Excellent.
Well, we'll talk to you later in the year. Thanks for joining us.
We'll
be back after these words.
Support for KPCW comes from the Natural History Museum of Utah, a nonprofit organization presenting a Navajo rug sale at the museum on Saturday, April 21st. Produced by Navajo peoples of the Four Corners area, these stunning textiles have been sought after by collectors for centuries. The Natural History Museum of Utah is located just minutes from Park City and the University of Utah's Research Park. More at nhmu.utah.edu/Navajo.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch